time to thrive. Welcome to the Thriveology Podcast with Dr. Lee Bockham. Join us as we explore ways that you can thrive in your life, regardless of what life throws at you. It's your life. Time to live it.
Hey, this is Lee Bockham, full-time thriveologist and part-time thrivalist. That means I am always studying the science of thriving, and sometimes I'm living it out. Yeah, we all struggle with thriving and how to have a full life, but it's not enough to survive. It's time to thrive. We're built for that. I think we're built for that, and we're built to thrive if we can just get out of our own way. So join me as we explore ways to thrive. Today, I want to talk about how our biology gets in our way. Now, last time I told you a little bit about how I got here. Today, I want to talk a little bit more about how we all move in the world in a couple of ways. And so first, we want to talk about biology, and I want to start with a little bit of a story. Back when I was a young guy, I was probably in eighth grade, my parents sent me to summer camp. Now, if you're imagining a lovely place with a nice, beautiful pool and nice cabins and furnished well with a great mess hall with good food, let me change your thinking a bit. They sent me instead to a wilderness camp. I don't even think they knew how wilderness it was, but it was a wilderness camp. Our cabin, if I put that in quotes, was really a canvas tent with a wooden platform that opened at both ends, and we were on cots, more like military surplus cots. And in order to get to the mess hall, we had to hike about a half a mile up and down on a rough trail, and that was kind of the life of the camp. Now, there was a lot that I enjoyed about the camp, but it was a lot more rustic than I think my parents had imagined. In fact, in order to get our food, we had to hike up to the main shelter and take out a trash bag of food products to take back to camp in order to prepare the meals. So what happened was, one night we were in our little tent area. They call it a cabin, but really the tent. And the people who were with us, you know, the adult leaders, were in their own little tent a little bit away from us. And one of them had gone down to meet some other guys, so we only had one of our leaders near us. And so when the counselor was gone, he was coming back up at the path long after we had gone to bed, long after we'd at least tucked into our sleeping bags, and he started yelling. He was calling for his fellow counselor. And unfortunately, the fellow counselor had gone to sleep. And not only had he gone to sleep, but he had a boombox on. You remember those old, back in the 80s, those boomboxes? And this was in the 70s. And so he was listening to that, and we could hear the music, and it was impossible for him to hear the yelling of his counselor friend. And so we went and got our counselor, the one that was still there. And as we were going to get him, the other counselor was yelling at us to not come towards him and for us to go back to our cabin as soon as we got him up. And so we did that. But, you know, the curiosity got the better of us. And so we kind of followed the other counselor a little bit at a distance and back behind him. And what had happened was, our counselor had stumbled upon a rattlesnake as he was coming up to the camp. And it was a pretty good-sized rattlesnake. And they managed to corner it and actually capture it. And they were worried about our safety, so they took it down to the main hall. Well, the next day, we all got to visit the snake. That snake had been put in a cage, and I remember it vividly. I would walk towards the cage, and the tail would go up, and you'd hear, and you'd back away, and he'd go, and he'd calm down. Walk toward him, back away. If you got close enough, he would strike the cage, and we being who we were at, 12 years, 13 years old, we enjoyed getting close enough that he would strike the cage. Couldn't get to us, but he had a raw nose from us coming closer to him and away from him and listening to the rattle and making him strike the cage. Not real kind of us, but it was an interesting lesson for me. Now, let me tell you how that ties into thriving. You see, there's a theory, the triune brain theory, that was proposed way back in the 50s and really was laughed at by science that has now been proven to be accurate. The triune brain theory says that our brain is really a combination of three different brain structures. And they go from the most core primitive part outward to the most recently developed part that we like to think of as what our brain is, our thinking part of our brain. But really, there are three layers. And it's important to understand these three layers because of how they impact your capacity of thriving or just surviving. So let's start at the most primitive layer of the brain. That most primitive layer of the brain has been called the reptilian brain. Now, the R-complex brain or the reptilian brain, or some people have said brain one, is the most primitive part of the brain that really is only looking for how to fight, how to flight, or how to freeze. Those are the three strategies we have when we feel like we are under attack. We either fight, take on the enemy, we either fly away from the enemy, or we freeze in our space hoping that the enemy will not see us. Rabbits take that freeze thing, thinking that they're not going to be noticed, right? And deer, that they'll often do the flight thing because they have no way of really fighting. But other animals have that fight. Can I take you on or not? Now, we share this part of our brain with everything that walks, crawls, swims, everything that breathes. We share it with those pieces because we all need to survive. We all share that structure as a survival mechanism. Reptiles have only that piece. Cold-blooded reptiles have only that piece, which is why it's called the reptilian brain. There is no emotion to that. It's only about whether something is big enough to be taking over, or do I need to get away because it will take me over? Am I big enough to handle the threat, or do I need to get away from the threat? That's all that part of the brain does. When I was messing with that snake, there were no emotions attached to it. He wasn't angry. So when I backed away, he calmed down instantly. When I approached him, he became aroused and ready to fight, or at least ready to try to scare me off. And so there was an interplay between me and that snake where I had some terror, except for it was in the cage. The snake had no emotion and was only judging, was I too big of a threat or could the threat be handled? Which is why, as I would approach and pull away, the snake would begin to rattle and then slow down, right? And so those are the two mechanisms that it was judging. When you get close, you're a threat, and I've got to try to scare you off. When you back away, there's no threat, and everything's okay. So the reptilian brain is that most primitive part, and you have it within you. Then there is another layer on top of that, the mammalian brain, the limbic system. Now, where the reptilian brain is very primitive, has the amygdala and hippocampus as the two primary pieces. The mammalian, the limbic system, really adds a whole other layer. It brings in emotions. It's the part of the brain that we share with warm-blooded creatures, because we warm-blooded creatures tend to look for the pack. We want to have connection, and so it brings in emotions, because without emotions, there is no pack. There is no grouping. We have to have some relationship with those other things. And so we have this extra layer of emotions that create the allow us that place of connection with others. And so when you're talking about the warm-blooded, there are emotions involved. For example, if you have a dog, you know that dog is recognizing that somebody's got to feed it, right? And so if you mistreat the dog for a long time, the dog is just going to put up with it, has no choice, knows where the food's coming from, and so it stays calm. But one day, sometimes we hear the stories of how suddenly that dog suddenly turns angrily and starts snapping and biting, not because of what happened then, but what happened along the way that finally it had fed up with what was going on and had an emotional outburst. Or think of the story of the elephants, right? The elephants that have been tied up for years and years and years and mistreated and suddenly go on a rampage. Now, they were able to overcome the immediate reptilian response of the brain by knowing that there needed to be connection. They needed to stick in that pack. They needed to somehow be connected with the caretakers in order to get their needs met. But then one day, enough's enough. And suddenly it boils over in emotions. So you have the reptilian brain, and on top of that, the mammalian brain, the limbic system, that adds that emotional response. And on top of that is the neocortex, which we are most proud of, but which is the easiest to go offline when something is happening around us. The neocortex is responsible for reason, for logic, for language. Now, as far as we know, we have most clearly defined language in humans. That there may be some other animals that communicate with sounds, but as far as we know, we're the ones who are able to use those words to think about what might happen down the road and what has already happened in the past. And we use that as a way of kind of running our lives, and we assume that what we're doing is making rational, reasonable, logical solutions to situations, when in reality, research is showing that the neocortex is really trying to justify what the reptilian and mammalian brain have already opted into, that there's an emotional response, a survival response, that then the neocortex is trying to decide how to discern. And so while we think we are making reasonable, logical, rational solutions, most people watching can recognize that that's not always the case. So how does that work in real life? Let's talk about a common situation. You're driving down the highway, you round the corner on the expressway, and there in front of you, traffic has come to a standstill, and you barely have time to hit the brakes. And guess what? Your rational brain is not responsible for hitting those brakes. It would take too long. Your reptilian brain, looking to survive, is hitting that pedal instantly to bring you to a stop just short of the person in front of you, if you're fortunate. And so as you're coming around, that's the part of your brain that has been scanning all along, watching to see what the threat is. And so it sees that threat, and before you can even register, slams on the brake, you come to a standstill, hopefully before you hit the bumper of that car in front of you. And as that happens, you have a rush. The first thing that happens is your body is flooded with adrenaline. You can feel it all pumping through you, and your fingers might tingle, and you might have a whole lot of other feelings in your body as the adrenaline comes from that most primitive part of the brain, the reptilian brain. But then the next thing that comes after that, after you heave a big breath of relief, then come the emotions. Suddenly your limbic system jumps in and is either angry with those crazy people in front of you that stop like that, or is relieved and feels some joy that you were able to stay safe. That's that limbic system that adds the emotions on top. And then the neocortex begins to go, wow, I've got to be more careful when I'm driving here. I've got to watch what's going on. I've got to be paying attention, because I was listening to that tape, or I was looking at that text, or I was doing whatever people do in the car that keeps them from paying full attention. And I'm so lucky I'm still here, comes the reasonable, logical response. Now, here's the thing. We don't want to find a way of turning off the reptilian brain. You can't. There's no way to do that, and you really don't want to, because you want that part of the brain protecting you when you're rounding that bend and suddenly the traffic has come to a stop. The problem is, in day-to-day life, while the reptilian brain is meant to help us survive way back in the savanna, in the forest, you know, in the jungle, where a threat, a shadow off to the side, was a real threat, it doesn't do so well in modern day, because it still responds as if it's the same kind of threat. If you think about it, we are naturally wired, overly wired for fear. Fear is a topic we're going to talk about more as we move through in future podcasts. But just understand for now that we are naturally wired for that fear. Why? Because if we were not wired for the fear, we would not have our DNA today. Those who were calm about the shadow lurking behind them, or just behind that tree, or over behind that rock, became lunch that day or dinner that day. Those who were hypersensitive, who were looking for the threat, are the DNA that got passed on to today, leaving us with a DNA footprint of being hypervigilant. There's only one problem. The threats now tend to not be real threats. The tone of a spouse, the actions of a child, of our child, the tone of a boss. There's something that will get us in a day-to-day life that are put us into a fight, flight, freeze place. We get into that response. We have that adrenaline flowing. We have those fearful responses when it's not necessary or helpful for us. And that's when our survival skills keep us from thriving. So the goal is not to live fear-free. The goal is to recognize that our fears play a role, but not nearly the role that we give them credit for. Sometimes we act as if our fears are going to somehow protect us. But when we do that, when we are constantly living an aroused place of fear, we're not able to thrive because it keeps us small. It keeps us from doing things. It keeps us feeling like the threat is there that we have to deal with. So what are you supposed to do about it? Let's talk about three things that you clearly want to know about how to deal with the biology of this. We're going to talk about the thinking part of this as we move forward. But right now, we're talking about the biology that gets in our way. The first thing is to be aware of this going on. Because when we are not aware that this is what's going on, we believe the fears around us. We believe those threats. We believe that our boss, our spouse, our friend, our children are really out to get us. We get into that place of concern, of paranoia, of the world against me. And when we do that, we are going to play into a fight or flight mode. There's just no way around it. So to be aware of that, notice it. So here's the next thing you do is begin to work on breathing exercises. If you don't know how to do the calming breaths, let's talk about that just for a few minutes. A calming breath is a breath that comes from your diaphragm. It's belly breathing. And the best way to learn how to do this is to lie down on a bed and put a hand over the middle of your chest, right on the breastbone, and another one right over your belly button. And then practice breathing, but practice breathing so that the only hand that moves is the hand over the belly button. When that hand is the one that's moving, you are correctly doing belly breathing. Now, see, what happens is when we feel like we're under attack, we tend to go into a natural phase where it's a physical attack. If somebody is fussing at us, we act as if there is a physical attack going on. And what do we need to do bodily-wise? We need to protect our internal organs, the ones that are most at risk. And they tend to be in our stomach area because right above that, we have the rib cage. Our rib cage protects us much better than those loose muscles below it. And so what we do when we are under attack is we tense up our diaphragm. We tense up our abdominal muscles, what we would call, if we're exercising, our core muscles, to protect those vital organs. And when that happens, the only place we can breathe from is our chest. So our primitive brain that really doesn't understand words very well takes that as a clue that we are under attack. When we breathe through our chest, it floods us with lots of adrenaline and floods us with lots of hormones that are preparing us for battle. The adrenaline does something very important. One is it gets our muscles ready to react in ways that are beyond the normal strength of our muscles. Two is that if we are injured, if we begin to bleed, our blood vessels will constrict and we won't lose much blood. What that does to our body, though, is it shuts down the blood flow to our extremities. It shuts down the blood flow to our stomach. And so then we have symptoms in our country like upset stomachs and maybe even constipation and difficulties that are related to the stress of those blood vessels being constantly constricted. The antidote is simply belly breathing, because when you do that, when you belly breathe, you're signaling to that primitive part of the brain in the only way it truly understands that you're not under attack. So let's say that you are in the middle of a difficult meeting, whether it's with your spouse or at work or somewhere else. You may simply want to put a hand over your belly button and begin to practice breathing there. When you do that, suddenly your body goes, okay, we're not under attack. Which leads to a response to your brain saying, okay, I'm not under attack. I don't have to begin to prepare the body for battle. The most important part is, one, recognizing that the arousal is happening in the body, the adrenaline is pumping, and two, to breathe and calm that down. Those are the most important parts, because there is no other way of communicating with that part of the brain. That part of the brain is so primitive, it doesn't understand language. However, interestingly, our thoughts can trigger the feelings of being under attack. You can work yourself up by the thought process into triggering that response. You can't calm that part of the brain down, but you can sure upset it, because when we start having thoughts, that leads to the limbic system having an emotion. Now, that's one of the errors that we have from modern day psychology, that it's the other way around. We believe that our emotions are somehow leading our thoughts, but in reality, our thoughts are creating our emotions every day of our lives. Now, I can prove it to you with a little experiment. If I were to ask you, and don't do this, please, but if I were to ask you to make yourself angry, what would you do to do that? I used to have people do this. The problem is it would take them a half an hour to calm back down. And so in the middle of a presentation, I would get everybody to make themselves angry. And then it would take a half hour to get to the place where they could hear me again because they were angry. So be very careful if you decide to do this little experiment. But you know what you're going to do. You're going to think about something that made you angry. So we're going to talk more about thoughts in future podcasts, but right now recognize that your thoughts can lead you back to the most primitive part of your brain, activating that fight or flight response. And when that fight or flight response becomes activated, it begins to be a cycle around and around and around because it begins to trigger more and more of those thoughts. And when we have more and more of those thoughts, we trigger more and more of that primitive response. It's a cycle that becomes very hard for us to break, even when there's nothing really going on. Okay, so a quick recap. Remember that there are three parts to your brain, the reptilian, the mammalian, and the neocortex, and as much as we would like to think that the neocortex is in charge, the reptilian brain and the mammalian brain are much more in charge of what happens in day-to-day life when we feel like there is a threat. Survival is about dealing with the threat. Thriving is moving beyond the threat and realizing that we can live above that, that it's necessary to have an emotional response when there's a threat. The problem is, way too often, we read in threats where there are none, and we respond as if we are under attack. And when we respond as if we are under attack and we get caught in fight or flight, our body responds in ways that keep us locked into that. And fight or flight only has two solutions. I'm either getting out of the way or I'm going to take you down. It's not about compromise. It's not about finding a common place. When we get caught in a fight or flight response with, for instance, a spouse, it's no longer about what makes sense for our relationship. It's about proving your point, scoring your points, and making sure that you're the victor or that you're not going to be the victim of that. So you get out of the way. That's what happens whether it's in a marriage or in a job situation or with friends or in our parenting or anywhere else in life. We get to the place where we lock away what makes sense and we fall victim to a place of fight or flight response that makes us to the most primitive part of our brain rather than working from a higher place. The higher place is a shift away from fear, and we're going to talk about how to do that as we go forward with these podcasts. In the next podcast, we'll talk about how our thoughts play into our lives and what we do from there. So until next time, I wish you the best. I appreciate you being here for this podcast, and let me know how we can give you more, how we can be of more of assistance. If you have some ideas about what we might cover in these shows, if you have some questions that you would like to pose about what we've talked about, please email me at podcast@thriveology.com. podcast@thriveology.com. We'll get it straight to my email box and we'll be able to know exactly what you want to hear from. I wish you the best as you continue to thrive. This is Lee Balcom.
Listening to the Thriveology podcast. Thank you for listening. If you want more information, visit us at Thriveology.com or at ThriveologyMagazine.com. Remember that Thriveology is spelled T-H-R-I-V-E-O-L-O-G-Y. It's your life. Time to live it.